Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too.
So I'm going to say hi and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara and today I've got a really, really interesting guest with me. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what's brought you on today?
Yes, of course, Tara. I'm John Massingham. I'm currently a youth worker, a youth support worker. So I work in London with young people and I hold a caseload of young people that are referred to me through the Safeguarding Hub.
And is it all right to ask what kind of ages at the moment? Because you've worked with early years all the way through. At the moment, what's the kind of average age?
It's 10 to 25 with SEN. So, you know, 10 to 19. And then SEN young people we take up to 25.
And we met just literally chatting at a social event, didn't we? And immediately I was like, I need you on this podcast because I haven't ever talked about youth before. I've done one episode about kind of parenting and dealing with young people, but I've never talked specifically about the kind of needs, the complexities of youth today, the stuff they're dealing with, but how it is we can kind of best support them as just individuals, parents, as educators. And that's what really interested me when we got talking, because are you comfortable telling us a little bit about your background? Because you worked with early years, you've done literally much, which is why I found you so interesting.
Oh, thank you. I will tell you about my background, but just to say first, the stuff with youth, there's so much there, and there is no answers, not direct answers. I think there's just a lot of work to be done with young people to support them,
and I really like that. We were talking about that off camera, weren't we, that sometimes people can get overly kind of stuck on fixing and solutions, and sometimes that isn't immediately obvious. Sometimes there aren't actual solutions. I like the fact it's just about having these conversations and learning, taking the time to just pause and go, what's going on here?
Giving them the agency to make informed decisions is probably a good way to encapsulate that.
Absolutely.
So, I was born in Australia and grew up there until I was 24. And came here. Before I'd came here, I'd completed art school and then went straight into youth work straight after that. And I took my art practice into youth work. I was doing murals in the town that I lived in Wollongong, or it's a city actually. And I really enjoyed engaging with young people and different groups of young people. So I had a deaf youth group. There was about six deaf youth children that used to attend the youth club with me on a Thursday night or something like that many moons ago. We had lots of migrant, newly arrived refugees as well that attended the space that needed some support. And then all different bunches of young people. You know, we've had concert on every Thursday night and we'd have 200 children. There'd be the skaters, the surfers, the goths, the punks, all of those guys. And I think I always had an interest in young people. I was the kid on the block that looked after all the other younger children, while our dads drank together on the veranda, very Aussie thing. And I came here. I ended up working in pubs because that's what you do as an Australian when you first come to London. And that's where I met my wife, which was all a great experience. And I felt like I couldn't relate to the communities of young people here at that point.
That's interesting.
I felt like I needed to embed myself a bit more. So after a while, I got a 6-hour-a-week youth work position. At a local borough, and then they had an adventure playground, and I fell in love with the idea of play work. So had play work as a theory, as a practice, and I was like, well, that's what I did in Australia. That's what we did as kids. This is cool. It's got some really good ideas about how play workers relate to young people and facilitate play, the play cycle. All of these things are really, really interesting to me. And so I worked in the adventure playground and I was looking for a permanent job, and I got two interviews, and both jobs were equally as important for me. And one was for a charity down in Streatham in South London, the Streatham Youth and Community Trust, who I loved working with. I worked with them for about 9 years, I think, from memory.
Long time.
I got this position, and they had a really rundown adventure playground in Streatham Vale Park next to a traveller site. And there was just a little bit of work needed to be done to get the communities cohesive and working together. And in the long run, I ended up achieving, with support from the other staff and senior management at Streatham Youth Community Trust, we got some football pitches in the park. We developed an adventure playground. I developed a forest school nursery after a stay and play. And I was really proud of that work. It was one of those things where I left at 5 a.m. from North London and got home at 7 p.m. every day that I needed to, and would set up everything. I loved forest school and I loved early years.
It's a really good model, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, it's that sort of pedagogy that you take the curriculum outdoors and you just use nature. And, you know, as simple, especially with early years, as simple as with the three-year-olds going, go and collect me three different types of sticks. And then we all just talk about what you collected and congratulate them. And it's that sort of embedding that ownership of learning and that love of learning. And I really love that. And because I've always been a nature boy. And then I was having a child. We were planning to have a child, and I was traveling so far each day, and I wanted to step up. They couldn't afford to give, we couldn't expand anymore, so I couldn't get a better wage. So I was chasing the money a bit, which I ended up regretting. I went to a nursery chain that was very competitive. I really was the square shape being forced into a round hole. I didn't realize until a year in, when I was really trying to fit their mold, was that I miss community work. Like, I felt like children were a number in this space, and that they were leaning on pedagogies that we weren't taught to teach. So I really felt like we were sort of bastardizing education or ripping off from, you know. And so I left there, and I got hired I took 3 months off, which was the best summer holidays, where the mate was out of work as well. So we had lots of fun. And now I've worked for a London borough doing targeted youth work. So that's that in a nutshell.
you've done a lot. The thing that really struck me when I met you, but as we were talking before we hit record, is just how much there's that kind of lived experience, your background in nature, your background kind of growing up and being that person to help people kind of communicate and spend time together, but also the kind of science-led, theory-led stuff. I think that's actually quite an interesting combination. This isn't just stuff you've learned. There's something about you being quite values-aligned, I think, with what you do. Okay to say people don't usually just step outside of jobs. There's something there about values not aligning and what it is that you see.
Over the years, I've thought the same way. Like, I thought that my art school experience helped my youth work experience. My youth work experience helped me getting to thinking about subcultures and youth culture, and then sociology as a major, and then media and cultural studies, and then education as a master's. And then coming to here, and then eventually seeing that venture playground and going, that's really exciting. I really like the idea of how we facilitate for young people to freely play. And it's actually like a value of mine is, I've got this little slogan, free play all day, which is like the hashtag free play all day. Not that if you hashtag free play all day, it doesn't go anywhere. Like, I haven't coined
it. We'll after this podcast.
Let's throw that out there. I always think that there's adding strings to my bow as I go, and hence why I'm now started a foundation level in systemic practice.
Tell us a little bit about that. So with everything that you do and your parenting as well, why take that on then? Where are the value? What's the value behind that? What are you wanting to bring?
Oh, it's a good question. I think it's because where the area I work now, there's a lot more thought in how we're working with families. Right. And it's not just that sort of old-fashioned way of I'm the worker, therapist, whatever, and I'm going to tell you how you can fix your problems. It's more about embedding that idea of agency and helping them have those conversations, and knowing that I'm a part of your system now because we're working together. So foundation level so far. So my systemic practice isn't all that good at the moment. But I think, yeah, I think it relates that way. Is that, yeah, we want to understand what my hidden biases are, what things I bring into a situation where I might be thinking about something because of a past experience, about lived experience,
yes.
What the family might be thinking of, having a burly, tall, white male that's Australian coming to help with them, and actually they're from Congo or something like that.
Yeah.
What does that mean for them? What do I represent? And I think that's the person that I want to be, is to be able to be reflexive in the moment and to be able to have those difficult conversations and be like, does this work for you? What is it about me that's not working? What can I change? I don't ever want to stop learning. I mean, I think that's something that I want to teach all the young people, is like, always try, yes. always have a go, you know. I know I did
almost
say
regardless
before.
Of the outcome. It's that, yeah, no, he said, yeah. That's something we were talking about off camera, wasn't it? That it's sometimes people are pressured, especially, you know, kind of through the school system, you know, that it's about what you achieve rather than the meaning and the value of trying and refining. And we might not get things right, or we may not get the outcome that we expect, but yeah. That's very, we both align, I think, because we both do a lot of values driven work. So it's not just around goals. And I think in British society, particularly, especially in our school system, it's still very much goal driven. You're measured yeah. by what you get. And I'm just wondering, when, you know, in your youth work, and we'll kind of unpick the nitty gritty a bit more, is why that doesn't work when you just have that focus on what you achieve, and that you were defined by your outcomes rather than who you are as a person and what your values are.
Yeah. Straight away I'm thinking, if you are judged on your achievements only,
yeah.
and you're struggling, then you're yeah. never going to find that empowerment through learning.
Absolutely.
And schools and colleges, unfortunately, are based on statistics of yeah. attendance, of
yep.
passing marks, and, you know, and achieving constantly. And yeah, yeah, there's SEN departments in some schools that are decent, but actually there's quite a lot of young people who are still yeah. struggling between those gaps. And that's where youth workers like myself will come in and support them in the school, and even have the conversations with school about, you know, this child has a one pager, yes. a passport of their learning needs. How can we get that embedded into all their classes so their teachers understand that they're not blurting out, they're actually on the waiting list for ADHD assessment? Why can't yes. we view them through the lens of SEN now, rather than when they've been diagnosed, because the waiting list is like 20 months or something in London.
Absolutely. And again, that's very tick box, isn't it, as well? And we know there's obviously this pressure. Diagnostics is a whole other kind of conversation as well, but it doesn't help people recognize that individual. And I think that's where I kind of click, because we met at a social event. It wasn't something where I was looking for a podcast guest. And that's often where I have the best kind of moments, or the best kind of, aha, my psychologist just brain just went, oh, I've never talked about this stuff. But the way that we quite align, I think, on the way that you talk about things, that even what you were saying there about, this isn't just about youth worker coming in and this is what we're doing to you, or talking to your teachers about, your system about, you take a really collaborative approach. You're about meaning and understanding, but also I think you're quite good at being vulnerable. You know, what is it about me that may be not helpful in this dynamic? That doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, I think there was a time where I wasn't. I think that I did, even in the last couple of years, like recently, I think there was a time where I was like, here's my remit, here's the work I'm going to do with the young person,
yes.
go for yeah. it. But then because of my workplace, we have this culture of learning,
yes.
this culture of being specifically anti-racist,
yes.
and practicing it, and being that is actually being uncomfortable sometimes. And reflecting on my white privilege. And, you know, I never had to think about my safety at times as a child. I never thought that about police
yeah.
targeting me. I've accessed education in two different countries quite easily. I've never had a problem with that. There's language barriers. Anywhere we go, everyone speaks English now. So it's like I haven't yeah. experienced these hardships that some of the young people and their families had. In, even on a daily basis, on how they navigate their communities, how they access different things, how they understand the systems that can support them, and whether they actually support them in a non-racist
yes.
way.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because there's a difference between, and I'm going to bring cognitive bias in here, so this is kind of extra sprinkle of psychology on top, is that I wonder if there's a lot of presuming. So that's what I wanted to ask you about, that this is being done, because sometimes people may think, oh, but you know, you're working with someone, you've got this support, you're doing this, you've got these opportunities, but how much of that is actually bias, you know, yeah. an unconscious bias, and how many people are taking the time to ask the questions? What are you experiencing? What is it like to be you as a youth in today's culture in London, where you work particularly? How many people are asking those questions?
There's so many thoughts now on that. Like, I'm just thinking about time in general.
Yeah.
You know, unpicking things for a young person, doing some identity work.
Yes.
That's like taking that time. But actually, yeah. I've got four other children I need to see today. So yeah. I can only give you this hour. And that's something that I'm always quite thoughtful of, because I'm like, no. If they're bored, then cool, I can see it, you know. Or if they're a young person that is ADHD and they've got an attention span of max 20 minutes and then we have a break and something fun, cool, I see that. But if actually we've just unpicked some stuff, how is that okay for me to walk away when actually some of that stuff was real and maybe raw, and maybe we need to be trauma informed, you know, in our practice. And then the other thought was the amount of young people that I work with who get stopped by the police and they're all black. And it just really feels like there is an evolution, but it's not the evolution. It hasn't come into full frost. People in authority positions aren't necessarily being as reflective as people on the ground in the community work are. And then inside that, the language that they use as well, because, you know, simple example for me is, you know, four black boys walking down the street as a gang, four white boys is not necessarily said that, you know, and that's very powerful to say, but I do really feel like, and I have been in meetings before where the word gang has been used and it's not been used in the way that I would use it. And I try not to use that word anyway.
But I think that's a really powerful example, isn't it? That even within systems that are supposedly then supposed to be understanding and have their kind of, you know, ear to the ground with what's happening, you've got that unconscious bias showing up even there.
There's no straight answer for any of this. It's just work to be done. But I would really hope that people like police or even doctors or psychologists at higher levels or even teachers did a module on youth work. Or systemic practice, something where they had to really look at a case study of young people and understand the hardships that they go through. And that's shared and personal, and there's so many layers to it for some of the young people.
In the kind of psychological world, that kind of aligns with what we kind of call formulation. You know, that really not just kind of rote learnt, this is what everybody needs. Because I imagine when you've got, you know, big caseloads in youth work, it can be quite easy to be more prescriptive. We've got this much time, so we need to do, this is our model. We have to have frameworks and models that we work from, but how much time is really spent, or how much capacity people have to even think, how do I formulate this person in their system? That's what I was really interested in terms of your kind of further training. You're doing that while parenting. That kind of shows who you are, doesn't it? That this matters to you. Because I'm wondering how much of this stuff then filters to colleagues, to other people you're working with, to families, to help them understand and be open and curious. That's very value-based work, isn't it? I do a lot of work around teaching people to just be open and curious. What's that like for you? What could it mean? I'm wondering what that experience is. Very compassionate language. And I don't work with children and adolescents. And that's why I really wanted to have this conversation with you, is what are our youth experience, and how often are people asking, how are you really? What is life like for you? We've just had a social media ban come in this week, so I think these questions are even more important. Are we getting it? Are there big gaps in what we're understanding? Big questions.
Just huge question.
throw them all at you. That's what I do.
There's tick box moments where I've noticed at school where it's like, there's a school I went to recently and I saw it said something like, on there they had some displays and it was said something like, teachers meet the child at the threshold to see how, that they're okay, and children get to greet their teacher at the threshold as they enter the class. And I was like, that language is not youth language to start with. This is a secondary school, and also that ticks a box for me. Like, do you actually go, how are you today?
Yeah.
Benny, you know, how's your experience been this morning? You don't, you can't, you don't have the time. So yeah. Let's be real. When you do notice something, do you actually engage in that sort of holistic way and go, let's talk, not just you're missing your lanyard. Because a lot of that, your shirt's untucked. There's a lot of just, we're just telling them what they're not doing right.
Yeah. Makes you a pupil rather than an individual.
Yeah, because then there's so many elements. You know, what was their morning like? Did they get breakfast? What's the family dynamics that's going on? What's your burdens? What's your worries? What's your concerns in general? Do you feel safe? All of these things where you're always going to get a dysregulated child if these sort of needs are not met. I think the youth, social media, the van, haven't really thought about it that much, but there is a lot of negative social media use.
There's
links with gaming as well. So for me and the work that I do, there's young people who are sitting up late using social media or gaming on phones, on PlayStations. And so there's a couple of things that impact them negatively. So school attendance the next day because they're not sleeping well. Then you get children who are continually either late or not attending school, and then they get down this cycle. So it's a lot of work with parents saying things like, turn the internet off, take the devices. But if it's gone on for too long, then you might get a quite threatening violent reaction from a child, a teenager, because they're like, you know, you're taking something that's really important to me. So let's have that conversation about how important it is so they can feel heard. I think also in social media platforms and online platforms like chat platforms when they're gaming, there's the fear of who's on there with them. So adults that are and a lot of the conversation. And the filter of what's being said. There's a lot of, you know, there's been in the past, from what I've heard, anti-Semitic conversations, homophobia and stuff like that, that's sort of spread through language by young people who are probably trying at first just to impress other people and they're not really understanding what they're doing. And then ostracizing one to impress the others or something like that.
Which is all behaviors humans have done. Beginning of time, just bullying, understanding it in this context.
Ours was just a little bit like, I can't undermine that ours wasn't as impactful as it is now, because it was
face to face mostly. Change. That's the difference, isn't it?
That's the other point I was going to make. Is like there's platforms like Snapchat where you can get. I could get the wrong platform actually, because I'm such a fuddy-duddy with social media. But there's cases before where I've heard and been a part of where there's been young people who have had an issue with another young person, and then they add lots of different people to the group so that everyone can air and hear this and see this.
Right.
And then there'll be an organized meetup where this young person wants to fight this young person, and then there'll be children who had got nothing to do with this situation from all different schools coming to see the spectacle, and then it just becomes this big hype of a thing. And you know, children get rallied up, young people get rallied up, you know, adults get rallied up when there's something that's going on. People seem to like
group mentality, isn't it?
And then it gets out of control, and then something bad potentially happens. And that's the thing about social media that I'm like, I would really like to see young people not using it, or having more safeguarding.
That's what I was interested to talk to you, because we were just talking off camera, weren't we? Obviously, because you're Australian, and I didn't realise they'd had a ban there. So I've kind of learned a lot this week in the media, but also from talking to you. But I think that's really important for parents to know, because I do think there's a lot of bias around why social media is bad. I'm a parent of two teenagers now. I was kind of thinking it's maybe what they're viewing kind of content related stuff. I think I've actually been quite naive until talking to you about that kind of behaviour, you know, kind of targeted harassment, abuse, and how quickly that spreads, and which wouldn't be the same if you were looking at face-to-face context. And that's really scary, isn't it?
But really scary. Listening to young people's feelings about social media, you can hear that they've been embedded themselves in it. They've got a sense of community in it. They've Some of them, that's their form of entertainment.
Absolutely, the way
they relax. You know, YouTube is massive with young people, and they just go down a rabbit hole of different videos and learn things. So many times I hear from young people, "Oh, I watched a video to do with this subject," and that. Or I'll say, "Do you need homework help? We've got tuition service we can help you with," and they'll be like, "Oh no, I go to YouTube for that." And I was like, "Wow, tell me about it." And they're like, "Yeah, I just learn about algebra or something like that." So they are resourceful, and the young people are learning to be resourceful through that and use it as a resource. But the safeguarding measures obviously haven't been good enough.
Yeah,
and that's why we need to, or that's why the government wants to change it, or there's some other political motive behind that. I'm a very skeptical person when it comes
to. And I think the thing that kind of struck me is I would support a ban, but the difficult thing for me is that when it's kind of just pulled out like that, you know, kind of rug underneath your feet territory, is are we or have we had enough conversations about how to help people kind of transition back to real world contacts? A reel with a psychologist the other day online who was making some really interesting points about how are we helping them to forge new communities face to face, and actually that's a kind of a transitional process. So I guess even just having conversations like this today is really useful. It's just, yes, as a parent, you know, you want to support a ban and you may put in measures and have boundaries, but it's also about understanding what you get from it, because that's where we get our information about, you know, what they're thinking, rather than just coming from an all-knowing. Obviously, we have to safeguard, but how often do we ask young people, what do you get from your social media? What would it mean to you not to have it? And I think those are important conversations, don't you?
Yeah, of course. And I think you just reminded me of how some parents use it as a tool to calm a child, like a younger child, like putting a YouTube video on of CBeebies or something like, what is it, Bluey. Everyone loves Bluey at the moment.
Absolutely.
And that becomes a tool, but why has it become a tool? You know, and I relate it to the same thing as like why children not learning to try their shoelaces as early as we used to. And that's from experience of tying many shoelaces of children who I think are old enough to tie their own shoelaces. And I think it's because of time again. I think we're rushing out the door because mum's got to get to work, and maybe that's a single parent home. And she's got to rush out to work. And actually there's no time to breathe and learn and make mistakes and try again.
Being vulnerable element.
Yeah. And so then thinking about social media in terms of younger children and YouTube as a resource.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throwing them in front. You go into a restaurant, you want to see your friends. You want to feel like you're still a woman, an adult, you know, who's connected with other adults, not just a mum or a dad.
Absolutely.
And just be able to have that half an hour with your friends to talk about life. And then you throw an iPad in front of the child, and then actually, what does that impact on, how does that impact on the child? I grew up in bowling clubs in Australia. Really? I was always taken down to my grandparents' house, who I loved dearly. Both sets of grandparents lived about 2 hours away from where we lived, about a block away from each other. So I'd get a week with them, and then a week with them, and then the summer holidays it'd be a bit longer. So I had lots of older people around me. I learned to communicate with older folk.
That's interesting. I wonder whether that's where you've kind of brought into your work that ability to just connect with people.
I mean, a lot of times we're just sitting around like playing cards in a bowling club while my granddad's doing bowls, my nan's having a cup of tea.
But it was face to face. It's human connection, which we need in our brains. Yeah.
And then we all know that what's happened after COVID and how many children are struggling with connecting.
Because during COVID, and that's the big thing that I haven't really seen many people talk about, is that was the only way of connecting for so long in COVID. So to a developing teenage brain, when you're wanting that autonomy and connections and you're becoming more open and curious about the world, that was what was, you know, it was facilitated. That's how we communicate.
How do we develop our identities?
Yes. And outside of tech.
It's through talk, it's through conversation, it's through the way that we attach things we talk about ourselves to ourselves, and the way that people attach them to us by accepting it in a way through conversation.
Well, look at how we met face to face in a pub, that's all right to say, at a birthday event, and you go, oh, that's interesting. What do you do? What do you do? This is so interesting. You think like this, and that really aligns with how I think. And then we have a wonderful podcast episode. That's the kind of essence of the connection, isn't it? Would it have been the same if we'd communicated online? I don't know.
No, and maybe it would have. I get quite nervous about doing things like this, and I'm not at the moment,
which is great.
But I also, going into it, because I'd met you there, and I was a bit grounded. I was a bit like, cool, I know that this is going to work. But that, like, thinking in terms of young people, like that sort of coming of age, making your identity, forming all these things that are important to you,
which is hard enough as it is.
All these other layers of stuff, your experience of what's going on at home, what's going on in the community. You know, some children are quite scared about where they live because they live in a bigger state in London, and there's some violence around them. I really don't like sort of the discourse around young people being violent, because it feels like it's they're owning it, and I don't really feel like young people wake up one day and just decide to be violent. I think there's always a reason that comes into it. I mean, probably my best analogy,
it's a really good point.
You know, a dog is not bred to be a vicious animal, but it will be trained to be a vicious animal if in the wrong hands. And I think
that's
there's
a really
layers
compassionate
of that
way of looking at what's the formulation behind it.
Yeah, and like on social media, there's anything happens in London, and it's all of a sudden all the comments, some people will be saying, "Oh, this is Khan's London. This is what Sadie brings to London. Oh, knife crime, da da da." And just having a go, and it's like, this is really not the way that we should be thinking about things. We should be thinking about what
judgmental, shamey, isn't it? Yeah.
What is it that's enticing or pulling out young people out of their homes to see and be a part of events like this? Because I don't feel like young people organize things like this. I feel like adults that are like syndicates of adults.
Really good point.
That are exploiting young people. And there's a trickle down effect and a triple up effect for the payoff. And I just really think there's a lot of exploitation going on in London, and that's why young people are making some decisions, because it's based on their poverty and they want to help out at home, or they just want to have the cool tracksuit and trainers that we all wanted when we were younger, so we could fit in.
And we can all identify with that. Yeah. It's so interesting. You just made me think that, because sometimes I have guests on the podcast and they will say stuff and it makes me go, gosh, that's so obvious, but why don't we all think that? Or is it because we haven't got the time, or we're not taking time, or bias takes over? Is that, in what society do we go, right, that behavior is a problem, and we just name it, it's problem, and never go, I wonder what's happened to that person?
I think our brains do that. We want a simple answer to something, and which we all do from sometimes, and you know, and that's that prescriptive way of thinking that as well. It's like, okay, you know, sometimes prescriptive youth work works. I need to link you with youth services. I need to take you to meet the hub, so you can
something
come
really
every
solution
afternoon.
Focused.
But I think our brains do that. We categorize things. We try and go, oh, that's rock. That's a heavy metal, that's this, you know, whatever, in terms of music. But
to
actually
make things a bit safer as well, Boris.
Yeah.
Well,
that's but it also keeps people in their place.
So can
we be uncomfortable to know that actually the dominant male discourse is not actually helping? Or what can we learn from cultures that we're not giving enough value to? Which is something that I think about with Australia, and I don't have much to do with Australian politics. Or I've got all my family live there, apart from my wife and child is here in London. But I've never really participated in following any sort of politics, even here, that much. Yeah. It's just something that makes me a little bit like uneasy, because of I just don't believe that you're doing it for the right of people. Yeah. You're not on the ground.
That doesn't align with the values that we've learned.
My values.
In terms of this conversation,
I really feel like strongly that the Australian people and the government have never given the Aboriginal Australian people the value that they should have, their voice in Parliament, their permanent seat in Parliament, their learn from the knowledge that they have about managing the land, all these things that we didn't value. And probably because when Australia was settled, it was violence. You know, we took away, and they're a peaceful people. Whereas the Maoris from New Zealand, they fought And so they have a lot more, in a way, more power, more respect in their country. Yeah. And it's not that the simple answer is not, oh, you fought and so that so you found your place and you didn't, so you got assimilated into all sorts of things. It's actually about the dominant discourse, the dominant way of thinking, and how can we change that way of thinking?
How do we change that? So if we come on to that, what if you could give anybody a bit of advice or kind of next steps, how can we start to think differently and have different conversations around our youth?
I mean,
another big, bold, classic question.
So many big questions.
I'm making you work really hard. You're so glad you came on now, aren't you?
I'm working for it. Yeah, I'm going to deserve that beer later. I think it's got to do with reflective practice, and I think that's got to do with schooling. I came across the idea of reflective practice through art school, because you need to, you don't just paint a picture and go like, look what I've done. You need to be reflective on why you've done it, what composition, tonally, all these things that that add up to be the image. And so in community work, that's that reflective practice about who am I and what do I bring, what's my head full of, what is actually junk and I need to get rid of, and what can I work on myself.
That's a good metaphor, yeah.
And how can I put myself in the position to understand you better? So, you know, again, use an example of like maybe it's a migrant family, and we go in there to help them, and we need to be trauma informed. You know, they might have come from somewhere that was very violent, or they might have had a very, very bad situation even just getting to us. And then they're trying to navigate systems, and they might be having a really tough time with that and not feel valued and heard.
And sometimes with trauma as well, it's not obvious to an external person what they're experiencing. Is it right to ask you, some people may have heard this kind of term trauma forms being used more and more now, but some people may not know what it actually means. So when you kind of talk about being trauma informed in terms of your youth work, what does that mean for you?
I think it's about thinking about what you say and do in person and not assuming that you know about things.
Yes,
but I also think it's about understanding that if there was explicit trauma that you knew, like through the referral or something, about how you tiptoe around that if you need to.
Absolutely.
Or how you, and maybe it is a conversation on that first meeting of, do you want to talk about this?
Absolutely.
Or would you like to leave that with the work you do with CAMHS, with the Children, Adolescent, Mental Health Service? And so I think it's about acknowledging that it does exist, if that's right. But also it might be not unpicking something, like exploring something to do with identity, and you're asking about parents, and actually your parents were died, and that's why you migrated to the UK. And you were not sensitive enough to read that in the
information. That's a really good point. Absolutely. Yeah.
Or if they tell you, then to remember that. So next time. So I think it's that balance between acknowledging stuff or at least having a surface conversation about where we can go with these things or not go. Because what you also don't want to do is open a can of worms and then you're just like, oh, okay, see you next week. I'm not at the moment a trained therapist. You know, obviously we lean on some of that stuff, but I'm not like you are and have been through all that training. What right do I have to just leave this young person at school after period two, the rest of the day, just in a bit of a tiz, and then maybe they go out to the playground and someone says something and it triggers them, you know? Yeah. So it's just about that. I think it's about that sensitivity the most, of like trying to get to know your client and establishing rules and guidelines.
Yeah. And I think being trauma-informed, you know, people are talking about it so much more now, which is great. Mm. Is that sometimes, you know, people are really compassionate to workers in any kind of healthcare or education setting, is sometimes, you know, your brain is going, I am a youth worker and today my job is, and you may have, you know, guidance, I've got to get through these questions and do this or refer here. Trauma-informed is also just about going, what has that person been through that might mean they're experiencing trauma or PTSD, and that can affect you know, impact your mind, your body. People can have flashbacks, intrusions. So if you're asking the questions that are part of your job, you may not even realize it inadvertently. You could be like re-traumatizing or not holding. It's about holding space. And I think you made a really good point. You don't actually need to be a trained therapist for a lot of that stuff. Being trauma-informed is just about being a compassionate, empathetic human. And it comes right back to what you said about if you are taking the time to helicopter out and get to know that person and their system that they've come from, the system they're trying to integrate in currently, if they've come from somewhere else or moved in the area, it's stuff that takes time. And it's just, you know, it's not rocket science either. It's just having compassionate conversations from what you're saying.
And sometimes it's as the worker, it's the pushback on going, I know that I got 6 weeks to get this work done, but I need more time because this is not okay. I can't get the information we need to do our assessment and I can't do my one-to-one work with them until I get all of this other information and I can't push it more than
that's about that kind of ethics as well, isn't it? And moral kind of duty of care type. And kind of safeguarding because you're safeguarding that individual. Sometimes I think people will think of safeguarding as more about external issues impacting someone, but actually you're safeguarding them and their kind of psychological health, aren't you?
I suppose we do that in the beginning as well, of like, you know, especially with young people, it's like, I'm here for you to talk about anything you want to, but if you disclose something that's really sort of give them that idea of why I would have to make a referral or talk to MASH about something that was disclosed, and maybe even your parents. So I don't not want you to tell me, but you need to know that if we need to talk about that might be a bigger conversation.
That's about informed consent and kind of, you know, helping people to have, I guess, psychological safety as well, isn't it? That, you know, you're there to listen and hold, but there are also boundaries that you have to have as part of your work. So I'd like to just let us know what MASH means if people aren't familiar.
Oh, Multi-Agency Safeguarding Hub.
So sometimes there may need to be a referral to a specific agency where they might look at someone's needs and risk. And that's part of it, but that's all done under that kind of empowering and empathic model. That's what that person might need at that time.
It's definitely a duty of care for me. Yeah. It's definitely like that's my role. Like, and I'm here to safeguard children, really. Like, so even if the child was like, I don't want you to do that, I'm like, but you're this age and you shouldn't be doing those things. I need to do this.
Yeah, you know, and they may not understand that at the time, but when they look back, they will. I'm just wondering how many people you've worked with where you go, what have you done for that individual, you know, to allow them to go on?
I mean, a similar thing would be like, and if I was at a shop, and it's happened to me many times when I was a bit younger, where there'd be a group of young people and I'll be just out there. I always wear like a band t-shirt and they're like, oh, can you buy me some cigarettes? And I'll be like, no. And they'll be like, oh, you look like you'd be cool and do that. And I'll be like, no. And then I literally go like, I usually say I'm a teacher. And they're like, well, I'm like, I can't. I have a code of ethics, so I can't do that.
Absolutely.
For you. Or alcohol. It's been, many times that's happened in Australia and here, where I'd be like, no, you just can't. I can't cross that line. And
that sometimes putting in boundaries is a good thing, as in it's empathic and it's actually very good for them. But sometimes we might struggle with our dissonance.
Yeah. I mean, I was them at one point. I did that when I was trying to get things when I was a kid. And I think that's also a really important part, is acknowledging, your own, you know, obviously I don't disclose a lot of things that I did as a young person with young people that I'm working with, but every now and then it might be a story that's got a bit of distance to it. So it'd be like maybe about peer relationships, and I'll be like, I had a friend and it was my best mate, and he used to be the guy who would always get us into trouble because of this and this, and one day he did this and we got in trouble for this. And so this is that conversation about trying to get them to understand that with some young people you can have them over at home, they can stay for dinner, they can have a sleepover, you know, adults in the house, but actually moving through town with them is a little bit dodgy because they're always a bit of a liability. So how did we make that informed decision to go like, you can be there, or I'm not coming with you on that, but you can come to my house and play? Because that's a lot of a problem with young people, that they feel like they have to say yes. I grew up with you. I have to back you because, you know, you just started.
Quite rule-bound thinking, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a lot of sort of with respect and loyalty, this unwritten rules for youth.
That's important to know, though, for our understanding of why it is that people may engage in certain behaviours that adult, more logical brain thinking about it might go, why would you do that when you know potentially the outcome could be this? Yeah. Because they're being guided by their own internal rules or kind of group
their
rules.
Their own old code of ethics, their own values and loyalty. And when I do core values with young people at work, I always talk about friendships.
That's really important.
When to find their core values, I ask, think about your friendship group.
Yeah.
What is it about each person that you like? One word. And then so someone will say, or a sentence, and someone will say, oh, he always backs me up. And I'll be like, cool. So that's like loyalty. And they're like, cool. So we'll put that down. And then think about someone else's funny. My mate's this one, this guy's so funny. And I was like, I surround myself by funny people as well. That's important to me. And all these, and so by thinking about
your
others,
then, and shared experience is helpful to them, right?
Yeah. And so I will share with them my core values of, you know, I'll always back someone if they're a trier, or if you know, if hard work, that's that sort of. I think that's. I think that a lot of people our age and relate to that.
No,
that our parents worked hard, and we saw that. And so we're like, it doesn't matter that if we're rich or poor, we actually just got this idea that you were trying for us, you know.
And that would encompass all sorts of other values. And I like that, because I think that's quite important. Actually, there's been a shift in psychology recently that, you know, I was trained to be very much a separate human who was just the kind of therapist. Is now we're starting to bring in a little bit more, obviously within appropriate boundaries, but just to go, look, I'm a human too. And sometimes I think this, or I've had this happen. And I think actually for young people, that probably helps make a safer kind of foundation for a conversation. I've had that, or I've had. And I think that's actually a really healthy thing to be able to demonstrate.
And there's, because there's such a distinction between a student and a teacher.
Yes. Yeah.
And then a youth worker comes in who's covered in tattoos, and they're like, there's visual signs to them that they can be on a simple level. They could be, I think that's cool, or I don't think that's cool.
Yes.
But it also can be you're a bit more like the people I am around.
Absolutely.
Or there's something about, or if you know they're into a certain type of music, then I will talk about that, or I'll actually go and listen to it and then talk to them about it, or even a video game. I don't play video games that much, but my wife does, and so a young person will talk about a game and I'll be like, oh, I know that one, my wife plays that, and then tell me about it. And it's actually quite funny, because I remember
conversation
jingles. I remember jingles. So like, so video game music, sometimes I'm like, they're playing a certain game and I'll be like, blah, 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 and sing the thing. I'm like, how did you know that? I was like, my wife plays it all the time while I'm sitting on my phone or playing with the baby, and I can just hear this thing coming all the time.
And that's the wonderful role that humor can play, because that connects people. And I imagine if you're working with someone who's traumatized, or they're going through something maybe at home that they can't speak about, or been told they can't speak about, is that's how you forge meaningful connections and create psychological safety, sometimes through humor, through just having a platform where they can maybe just go, do you know what, this person's okay and I feel safe, or there's something I relate with. We scan our environment all the time, part of the threat brain. If somebody, you walk in and you know you have tattoos and they go, ah, that's kind of something I know, or it seems familiar, that's really good for the threat brain. It's really good for them opening up and forging those relationships. And that stuff, I don't think you can't learn that. It's not prescriptive stuff, is it? That's just where I think you have. And I think that's why I kind of connected with you so well. That lived experience, that ability to read humans, and obviously the training and then the framework that you have in terms of your work, is actually a really magic combination. And that's why I wanted people to kind of hear this. So there may be people going, oh, but I don't work in a youth service, or I don't work directly with people, or it's any, you know, you could be sat on a train or a bus and there's youths, you know, just saying hello, having conversations. You could have friends that have teenagers. You could be doing something more formal, working in that area. We can all take something away from this conversation about how we better, the things I've learned, how we just take that time, maybe move away from absolute quick fix to just, what do I need to understand about myself? That's a massive thing I've taken away. And what I'm bringing to a conversation, therefore how I'm going to work with someone, but what that individual has come from, who they are, what they need, before we even start to think about the more practical doing elements.
You made me think about authenticity.
Yeah.
And like, so absolutely. Like in subculture theory, they talk about authenticity. So like at the skate park as a kid, the older skaters would come in and they'd be like, oh, they're doing this wrong or something. And it was about like ownership or being a part of the group. So that authenticity of what you're wearing, what you're doing. And because I remember as being a skater kid, we'd go like, oh, there'd be this new kid coming to the skate park, and we'd be like, oh, he's gone to the shop. He's got his mum's bought him new shoes, new skate, right. The proper shirt. Da, da, da. Oh, he's a skater now. And that is what culture, our yes. sort of commercial yeah. culture is. Hip hop, all of that. You know, you sell yeah. product to become that person.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
So that authenticity in youth culture yeah. is obviously dynamic within the different communities of youth, and. As adults, we're not in that group. So, you know, our judgments are felt and their judgments to us are felt as well. Don't worry Absolutely. About that. But there's, how do we get to break that barrier, that difference and value it? Because my job is to empower, educate, get children to participate and have an equality to my work so they can make informed decision making, really. So how do
core
we
skills for people as they go into adulthood?
Yeah. And so how do we embed a sense of value and community in our young people so that they can feel that they can participate and push on and become the people that they want to be.
And deserve to be. That's the thing that really struck me as I was talking to you, is that, you know, our youth deserve to be heard and to be understood, and they deserve patience and time if they've been through or are going through difficult things. But the one thing I haven't asked you then, you do all of this work. How do you look after yourself? Because people might be, you know, as another healthcare professional myself, it's hard.
It is hard.
You're, you know, you're a parent, you're a partner, you're a friend, you know, you have your own needs and you absorb stuff. So we've talked about trauma, vicarious trauma. What do you do?
I think there is obviously times when you just, your cup is so full.
And then
it's good to talk about. With my work, I can turn around to my line manager and be like, I'm just going to have the morning off.
Good.
Or, there was actually a child protection meeting that I had to sit in that I was working with the family. And it was a really long meeting. And during the something was disclosed that I didn't actually know, and it really hit me because I was really close to the parent that said it. And so afterwards I was like, I'm just going to go up to the Hampstead Heath and just walk around in the trees and make myself happy. But also it's about my network. Like, I like the idea of building communities, and anyone who knows me knows that I've got solid friends in London, and I was never born here. My wife was born here. And so I've been here for on and off for 20 years, but probably for 15 years this stint. And this is my home. And I've got friends from all walks of life. One of my best friends, Bruno, was born in Brazil. He was my bar back at my first job in Camden Town. Right. I'm meeting him this afternoon because at a festival last year, I met a guy from Singapore. And he was by himself, and he's just flown in tonight to see us because he works for Singapore Airlines. And he was like, I'm flying to Gatwick. It's the first time I'm flying this far. Are you around? And I'm like, well, it's my birthday tomorrow, so we can meet up tonight. And he was like, great. And so we met at a festival where he didn't camp like we did. He was going back and forth to a hotel all by himself. And he does that all the time. And he's been three times this festival and never made sort of close friends. We've been in contact since. And I think what I'm trying to tell you is that's the person connection. I am. I try and connect with people, and then I try and keep those connections solid. My best
valued
mate and his partner live across the road. And that happened over COVID because, you know, there was full conversations about let's have a community around us. I remember when I met Anne and her parents for the first time in this house, and I knew they weren't as social as me. And obviously there's a drinking culture that comes with being social, especially in Australia and that. So I wanted to be explicit that, you know, you will see that I go to lots of gigs. I attend lots of music events because I'm big into my music, but also we'll go and see mates and I will go to check in with them. And
is that good for your decompression from work?
That's my decompression. I don't necessarily talk about what happened at work. But a couple of times I have, because it's been a lot, but obviously without disclosing names and places and stuff like that. But it's about just spending time with them and them allowing me to just decompress, I suppose.
I call that allowing space sometimes. It's you know, especially people kind of know what you do. You don't necessarily need to talk, as you say, we obviously have to be very confidential in our jobs as well. But I guess, and that's why I kind of like talking to you and I got to meet you recently, is that we kind of aligned, I think, a bit on that, where you just kind of get it. It's an unwritten thing, isn't it? Of, yeah, you do similar. We hold a lot, and sometimes we need to decompress.
You notice the people that were around us when you met, they're really similar to that, and they're the people around myself. That's like really easy going, but they've got your back. They've got your back in that way of like mentally got your back. Absolutely. Like, I'm here for you if you need anything.
Which in the work you do, you will need, because you're absolutely right. I love that metaphor that you can't give from an empty cup. That, you know, if you do a job that's really values-based, and that's really come across today, that you deserve and almost have to kind of monitor how much you've got in your cup to be able to give to that job that you love and that you're very innovative. So it's not just a tick box job, is it? You develop, you want to give more, but that can take from our cup more, can't it? And then parenting, let's not even go there. That takes a lot. It's beautiful and wonderful and tiring and everything in between. And, you know, just having time for yourself. And I'm really grateful that you've made time for just things like this. You know, it's not just quickly pop on a podcast, you know, you have to prep and it takes time. So I'm really grateful that you've taken the time.
It's been good. But there's a big value in talking about the work you do, or even the art you make, or something like that, because you get to, or what you're studying, because you get to know it better. You embed it when you talk about it. Then you start embedding that learning a bit.
I can see that in what you say as well. You know, this what you do.
It's a big value.
And so I always ask everybody, I've had so much wonderful information for you, but my kind of signature move on this podcast, it shows my age because no one says that anymore, is if I could ask you for one little adversity takeaway, one little thing that you could leave us with, what would it be?
I mean, I think for the podcast, it was about I said time quite a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I really feel time is compressed for a lot of us, you know, running out the door to get to work. And actually,
resonates.
You know, I've got to go to, I mean, even with the other children who are living maybe more comfortable lives, their French lessons on a Monday and this on a Tuesday afternoon and this and that. It's like, calm down, let them be kids. Like, let them go and dig a hole and fill it full of water and then do it again and get mucky. And
which is what we grew up doing, didn't we?
Yeah. And I think that builds resilience. Absolutely. It's like, know where the adults are when you need them, like, but actually go and take some risks. That are healthy risks, like developmentally healthy risks. I'm not talking about risky, like
you're in the Goonies or E.T.
Like taking adventure. And that's that thing, that moral panic of children being outside is a hard one to navigate in a city like London. But
absolutely,
really, we need to trust that children do make good decisions. And we can fuel that by talking to them about what they do, you know, and supporting them.
John, thank you. Literally, I've talked to you all day. We could do a whole series. I hope you found it useful. Well,
maybe we could do that. Maybe we could do that, and it could be something.
Especially because with the current climate. Yeah.
I've got people that I work with that are very inspirational to me, and that I've worked with for different jobs. You know, that's what gets you where you are as well. So, you know, there's been so many women in my life that have been inspirational, that made me really critically think about, you know, how we are as men and that sort of privilege, and inspire me to read or study more or something like that. And
that,
again, just colleagues.
Actually. Isn't it? I'm going to reel you in for another one. John, thank you so much. I'm really hoping people take the time to share this episode, because I think even if just one person listens to my podcast and starts to think differently, then we've done our job. So thank you. I know you're in the middle of parenting everything. Enjoy that beer later. It's well deserved. I think this is a great episode. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.